Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better.
Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast where we talk all things books and reading. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and I'm joined today by writer and scholar Dr. Damaris B. Hill. Damaris is the author of A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, which is her newest release. Before we dive into our conversation, here are just a few reminders for you. Everything we talk about on today's show can be found in the show notes. There's even a link where you can find all the books that we talked about on today's episode. Want more of The Stacks? Head over to patreon.com/thestacks to be part of The Stacks Pack. That's our own community that gets you inside access to the show. You can join our virtual book club, get the inside scoop, and a lot more. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks and check it out. Patreon is spelled patreon.com/thestacks. Before we dive in, make sure that you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts and that you leave us a rating and a review. It goes a long way to helping this show reach new audiences. All right, now it's time for you all to meet the wonderful Damaris Hill. All right, everybody, we are here today with our guest, writer and scholar, Dr. Damaris B. Hill. Damaris's newest book is entitled A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, and it's a collection of poems about incarcerated Black women. Damaris, welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you for inviting me to The Stacks, Tracy. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited that you're here. We're just going to dive in. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, like kind of maybe where you come from and maybe how you came to writing? I don't know. Or just okay. Anything.
That's a pretty interesting story. So I've lived mostly on the East Coast, but I have lived in the Midwest at different times in my life. My father is an AME minister. So is my grandfather and my mother and lots of people in my family. I'm kind of Christian plus. Okay. I'll make it to heaven. I'm just taking the scenic route thing.
Perfect.
But we've lived all over as a result of that, because on average, a Methodist minister moves about every 2 years.
Whoa.
I started writing. Okay, I want to start earlier than that. I started writing songs. Like I would hear. So when we lived in Xenia, Ohio, and my father was at this church called United African Methodist Church, outside of Wilberforce near Yellow Springs and Dayton and those types of places. Where we lived, the parsonage was not too far from the church. So I could hear like choir rehearsals and things, and I would try to write songs to that. But I wasn't very good at spelling. And so then I asked my parents, could I learn music? And they got me a highly trained classical musician that was at least 104. So I definitely
They are always.
So my music teacher when I was 5 or 6 is this highly respectable, classical, highly trained musician in the Midwest that surely knew Alice Dunbar Nelson by first name and had absolute disdain for all blues women, whom are my descendants.
Right.
So those lessons lasted about, I think we only lasted about 3 lessons. Okay. Like, I just couldn't do it anymore. And then from there, I just tried other art. Like I would, you know, everything that I would try creative, my parents would be like, oh, artist die poor. Hmm. And they would like pass me an engineering
book.
What
did they want you to be?
I think they wanted me to be something in the sciences.
Okay.
But the real key to this is what I didn't know until I was in my 30s, is that my grandmother was diagnosed schizophrenic.
Hmm.
But my father's generation and his sisters, none of them were diagnosed with the disease. But all of them thought the disease would show up in one of her 5 grandchildren.
Mm.
And me being an imaginative, creative little girl probably scared the living daylights out of everyone in my family. So rather than articulating the fear, they would just say, oh, no, the world has enough artists. Artists die poor. Like, you don't want that.
That's so interesting, because they were trying to dissuade you without like freaking you out.
Right. Like, again, like I had a son of my own before I even found out.
Wow.
What was going on.
Wow. That's amazing. So you came to writing just through being a creative, exploring all arts aside from classical music by elderly teachers.
But really, I mean, not that I didn't have an acumen for narrative, but this was an art that I could do, that I didn't have to beg for supplies,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't have to face the rejection of my parents telling me that artists die poor,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't have to go into some explicit strategy or advocating for these artistic supplies.
Right.
Like, it was easier to get toys, Legos, Barbies, clothes. It was easier to get any of those things.
Right, than to get like a dance shoe or something.
Or
paintbrush or.
Right. Like, I need a whole paint set. And,
right.
You know, it's like, what do you need it? What do you need that for?
Because they were like, no, don't go down this path.
Right.
That's like, so interesting.
Like, you already have paints in there.
Right. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but I just want to just kind of foreshadow. Next week, we're talking about Beloved, and I already feel like this is connected.
Yeah, very much so.
Like the history, family history, trauma, fear.
Absolutely.
Anxiety, all of that.
Absolutely.
Intergenerational.
Right.
Coming to you next week.
Right. And I open up the book with that poem about my grandmother,
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know at the time that my grandmother, you know, when she grew up, she was a voracious reader. She was named after Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Mm.
Out of her brothers and sisters that all graduated from college, they all say that she was the smartest.
Hmm.
She wanted to be a librarian. Like, I didn't know any of these things growing up. So me exhibiting all of these things.
Right.
Generated.
But they knew. That's so interesting.
Generated an anxiety, right?
Yeah. Wow. Oh my gosh. That's so interesting. And that you didn't find out till you were
in my 30s. Old. My aunt told me. Like, my parents would have never told. So then I had to like really question, because my parents were sending me to her house every summer for months.
Hmm.
And what I grew up, and this is a romantic story, but I grew up watching my grandfather serve my grandmother breakfast in bed every day.
Mm.
I thought this is what you wanted out of life.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that he was mashing up prescriptions.
Wow.
In her coffee.
Mm.
And it was really that type of labor. Maybe a labor of love for us as grandchildren, but it wasn't what I thought I was looking at.
Right. That's so interesting. Okay, so we're going to fast forward a little bit.
Please.
You then go on to become a writer
mm-hmm.
and a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
You are what I like to call a double doctor.
Ah.
2 PhDs, mm-hmm. which is like pretty major. And you write not only poetry, but also nonfiction. And I've heard from a birdie that you're working on your novel.
Yes.
So that would make you a triple threat writer.
My PhD is in fiction.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, right. English creative writing. I knew that.
No, but it was an
specifically
emphasis
fiction.
On fiction.
Oh, wow. But will this be your first book of fiction?
Well, this is my first creative book. So I have a collection of historical essays.
Right.
But this is my first creative book.
The poetry. I mean, the next poetry. Book. Because you're working on something, a novel,
yeah,
right?
I am working on a novel about girls that went to prison. And that book is just as queer as this one.
Great.
And I call it my little 12-headed monster. Yeah. It's pretty wild. One person that read it said that they were gobbling it up the first 200 pages, but the last 100 pages made them tired.
Ooh.
And I was like, yeah, because it's a video game and paper, baby.
I'm so excited for this book. Okay, but let's talk about A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing.
Yes.
It's a collection of poetry, but it also is, I mean, I don't even know how to explain how it functions, but basically you have this fantastic introduction where you know, kind of call the spirits of, you know, your family and a lot of the women in the book, in addition to men and women who have been killed by police and et cetera, et cetera. And then we kind of dive into these sections. It's five sections?
Well, I think it's more like seven, but it kind of functions as five.
Yeah. And then we talk about incarcerated women throughout the book. And with most of the poems and the sections, there's kind of like a prose introduction to each person.
Yes.
And so it's kind of a mix of, it's not just a straight book of poems. Like it has a historical context that you're giving to these poems and kind of like placing them in relationship to the world that maybe your reader will know or will be able to reference, which I found wonderful. It allowed me a little bit of freedom as a reader to understand where you were coming from or to see something in a way that I hadn't thought about it through your poetry, which is beautiful.
Thank you so much.
And there is a question in this.
Okay.
There is a question.
There's already like three questions.
I know. I sometimes struggle with questions. I don't know why.
It's so weird.
But I sometimes I'm like talky, and then I'm like, there should be a question on a podcast, but should is a silly word. How did you come to the idea of combining the poetry with the nonfiction introductions for them?
Okay. So I do want to admit, first of all, that some of the things that you appreciate in the structure, like the opening pages, that was definitely encouraged by my editor and my agent. And I was very resistant to that at the time. But I did it.
Why were you resistant to it?
You know, I think as writers sometimes, like writing is like the art of burlesque. And I feel like nonfiction is just like a straight strip tease. And I don't know if I was ready
to like show that much.
Yeah, to be bare and to show my pain in that way. Because I actually wrote that introduction after everything else was complete. And the last chapter in the book that's about my son and his struggles, and really the extended violences of the Black Lives Matter era, those things were not initially in the book.
Wow.
Yeah. And they came to the book late. Also, initially the way I structured the book is that the poems and the archives, the reclaiming of the archives, was all one section. And then all of the historical references were a lot shorter.
Okay.
And they were like kind of in the back as footnotes.
Oh.
And then my editor was like, no, we kind of need to move that because the only problem is we keep flipping back and forth.
Yeah.
So even though I made it a point to know these women intimately, I did have to think about that the reader did not have that opportunity.
Right.
To know these women intimately. And so they might need some support.
Totally.
In meeting these women. Okay. So let me go back because that was not what you asked.
No, but that's super interesting just to hear. I do have another question that's related to that. So maybe we'll do this and then we'll go back. But my question that's related to that is, how do you put together a book of poetry?
Okay.
Literally, not so much figuratively, like putting it all together, not like literally binding it, but like, how did you order it, structure it? How does it come to you? And how do you, because I'm assuming it doesn't all come to you in this order.
No. So for this book, I want to say, number one, that this is aligned with the theories of Ruth Nicole Brown and Dr. Shamara Kawachi, that when they talk about Black girlhood genius, they helped me to put language and purpose behind something that I was already doing. And what I try to do is to bring my whole self into my art and into my academic spaces, and kind of coming of age outside of New York City as hip hop is developing, my and house music. I don't want to leave house music out because that's a very important thing for me. Those were features and fixtures in my Black girlhood. So really what's happening in the book is what we're looking at is a type of literary remix where I'm sampling the archives, I'm sampling history, and I'm laying my lyrics on top, right? So it's important to think about that. But also, my writing process is very messy and requires a lot of editing. So I kind of say that I vomit on the page. And so what this is this is a fraction, like maybe less than a third of the poems that I originally envisioned in my first manuscript. This is my third first manuscript. Okay. So I had a manuscript in 2003. I went back and revised it and made it something different in 2012. And of course, I had a lot, many more experimental types of poems in there that were kind of wigging people out. But, you know, I'm about it. I love it. And then I had a mentor at that time, Chris Abani, who was also on my dissertation committee, now professor at Northwestern of Creative Writing. He read that second first poetry manuscript and he was like, which was placing, let me be clear. It was like getting recognition or placing with like Copper Canyon. Like I was rising to the top, Crab Orchard Review. I was a semifinalist. And he was like, oh, you're not getting the prize because this is really three books. And at that time in 2012, I kind of like sucked my teeth and rolled my eyes. I didn't say anything to him because he's brilliant. And I know better than to discredit what he's saying. But I was angry because it meant that I had so much more work to do. That's like thinking you have a poetry manuscript and somebody's telling you, no, you have three and you need to go ahead and finish these three.
And but the good news is that you have two more waiting for you. You're like kind of halfway there.
I'm kind of halfway there. And so I returned to the novel that I'm working on. I acquire a great agent, Charlotte Sheedy. Charlotte Sheedy accepts me. She reads my fiction. A year later, we have a meeting in her office and she finds out that I write poetry and nonfiction. She reads the poetry that day and says to me, your poetry is coming out first. She calls me on the phone. She's like, Damaris, your poetry is coming out first. And I'm like, okay, this lady is crazy because poetry cannot pay off my student loans. This novel can sell. And then we'll come back to the love of poems, right? And then she hangs up and she calls me right back. She's like, yeah, but this is not one book. It's two. So in my mind, I say, no, it's really three. But then at that point, I was ready for the work, which was 2 years later. But if Chris Abani hadn't said it to me, I might have fought her about it.
It was like already in your head.
It was already in my head. And I was like, she's right.
So is that how you generally work? Like you need, like you like to have an outside person kind of like to help guide you? Or do you feel like, I mean, that's how I like to work. Like I'll make a bunch of stuff and then someone will be like, oh, a little feedback. And then I'll be like, oh my God, I figured it out. But like that outside person.
Well, I think those outside people are very helpful because I do a lot of work in my head and I'm, you know, writing scholarship, fiction, poetry, and sometimes like, you know, this nonfiction thing. And I say thing because I'm trying to like hybrid my scholarship and nonfiction right now, create this kind of genre that's doing that. It's kind of roguish genre that's doing that. But for me, I can be so caught up in the task of finishing it. And then I also harbor a lot of shame and insecurity about my writing. I do not easily show my writing.
That's so interesting.
It's the most insecure part of my life still. I told you a little bit about my childhood. It is still the most insecure part of my life.
How do you deal with it? Because like, you know, your book is out in the world and people have read it. Like, I know you're aware of that.
I have a lot of anxiety about it.
Do you? What is, I'm not to be too personal, you can tell me to shut up, but I'm sure other people deal with this too. What is it about having your writing out that gives you the anxiety, or like, what is it?
I still look at poems and I want to change them. That's one. Mm. I don't think that they're finished all the time, or I think differently about them and I want to change them. That's one. Two, it's a real intimacy with yourself. And by extension, the world, when you're writing something. So you get 10 years of incubation or more with this piece. And then it's all of a sudden like you have this brand new amoeba that you're just exposing to the world and you're hoping it's going to make it.
Mm.
Right?
It's like you, like, comes out of you. It has to like be its own thing.
Right. Or it's like, you know, you are the shell of this egg.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it enters the poetry world. The shell is taken away.
Right.
Now this egg is just there.
Right. Right. But part of it is also that it doesn't, while it might exist, it doesn't really fully exist until someone else has read it. Right.
Yeah. So Kafka and I don't care about that. Another surrealist, yeah. Kafka and
yeah.
I
yeah.
are less concerned about that.
Right.
We're telling you it's not done. Right.
Right. Right.
And so even before this book, like one of my friends, Christy Cartwright, I remember she came over to my house and she's a writer from the Bahamas. And when her book comes out, it's going to be absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
But she came over to my house one Thanksgiving and she just started pulling things out of the file. She was like, this is done. This is done. This is done. This is done. Like, stop harboring this stuff. Send
right.
it out.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm really weak at sending things out.
Right.
And probably if I didn't have an agent, I don't know.
Hmm. That's interesting. So we had a guest on the podcast a while back. He's a children's book author. And so, you know, a lot of children's book authors, they go and they talk to kids and et cetera. His name's Jesse Bird. He's fantastic. He's just a lover. I just love him. Anyways, he said something at the end of the episode that has stuck with me, which was that you've got to go do your thing and you have to think of it as a public service, because imagine how many people would be uninspired if, or would be left unfulfilled if Michael Jordan had never played basketball or if you had never written your book of poetry. So in that feeling of like not wanting to let it go, you're being selfish with like your greatness and your thing. And I just, ever since he said that, I've thought about that a lot of like, I might be insecure, but what am I keeping from others? Like, my work is a service. And I just thought that was really nice.
Okay. I'll start to look at my work as a service, but it's a crazy relationship because I'm
right.
still trying to figure out, you know, I can't figure out the external value of my work.
Hmm. But maybe that's not for you. Maybe that's for us.
Yes.
Maybe you just
for
do the work.
Agent.
Yeah.
Right?
It's for the agent. It's for the reader.
And the reader.
And the people who are consuming it and who are inspired by you, right?
Okay, yeah.
I don't know if that helps, but maybe not. Well, we'll move off that. Okay, so this is like a real... I'm going to make you be a teacher for a moment.
Okay.
Because you do that.
Yeah, I do that.
You do that. So in your book, you talk about, and I might be saying this wrong, ekphrasis?
Yes.
And I Googled it, mm-hmm. and I tried to look it up. And I want you to explain what it is, because I don't know that I understood it. And I want you to explain how it functions in your book, because it comes up a few times in mm-hmm. the book.
Well, usually what we talk about when we talk about, I say ekphrasis, but I might be pronouncing
it
wrong. But when we talk about it, it's like poetry inspired by art, right?
Okay.
But because I don't really believe in categories, genres, races in that type of way, right? I believe all of these things are limiting, and they limit the complexity of human life. But I also believe it when it comes to art. And so instead of my work strictly relying on visual art, sometimes people can do some like scientific research and it's really a piece of art.
Mm.
Like I feel that way about theories about dark matter. I feel that way about string theory in physics. And I feel that way about the work of Callie Gross in her book, Colored Amazons. And she's a historian / anthropologist / sociologist / all things complex and great, considering Black female intellectual history. And when I read her book, Colored Amazons, I closed the book And I immediately started writing poems about the case studies, because it was the first time that I had read case studies that were done so humanely, that didn't reduce the woman to the subjugated status of an object. And I was moved instantly. And so there were really like 40 poems, but only 16 of them are in the book.
Oh, wow. So you went, you revised.
Yes.
You did your favorite thing.
Yes. So anybody that's not in the book, they're only not in the book because I think the poem wasn't good enough.
Interesting.
Not because they didn't deserve to be there.
Right. And do you find that that's how you come to your poetry often, that you have to be inspired, or can you sit down and just write or can you be commissioned to write something, or do you feel like it has to come from like that impulse?
I can be commissioned to write something, but I've always been the type of person where you can set an expectation, but you can't show me how to do it.
Okay.
And so even when I'm writing the poem, even if there's a designated subject matter, or let's say there's an expectation, my orientation to the poem is always unexpected. It always does something that I didn't intend for it to do. It becomes its own thing. My job is to let it become its own thing without editing it out. It's kind of like putting a wildflower in a vase.
Mm.
You risk losing the beauty.
Right. That's and such a good analogy.
Right. And so writing towards an expectation, right, or a certain goal is like taking this wildflower and putting it in a vase. And if it's not cut and positioned right, you lose the beauty of it because you've already reduced it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Okay, we're going to start.
When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stacks tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stacks merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestacks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestacks now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/thestacks. Okay, y'all, this past week, I threw a party in LA to celebrate the LA Times Book Festival and just generally bookish people all around. And it was the best time. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on Instagram, but I have to say a huge thank you to Lit Cocktails for helping make this party a total blast. Lit Cocktails is a mobile bartending company that provides a fun, personable, unique, yet professional experience for clients who want more than your average boring black tie bartenders. They're here for weddings, birthday parties, corporate events, or any other reason you might need to celebrate with a cocktail. Lit Cocktails is owned and operated by Diamond Davis, a Black LGBTQ woman who started the company after losing her job as a restaurant manager during the 2020 pandemic. Diamond has created more than just a service. It is truly an experience, and it celebrates diversity, love, and community. I could feel that from the bar the entire evening. Diamond was a joy to have. She made the best drinks, always had a smile on her face, and honestly became one of my new favorite people. Lit cocktail packages include ice, garnishes, cups, napkins, straws, a customized menu, two specialty cocktails, non-alcoholic beverages and mixers, one free hour of setup and breakdown, and an alcohol shopping list. Literally, you don't need to do anything but hire Diamond. She takes care of the rest. They also offer tastings for an additional fee, where they customize 8 to 10 drinks based on your flavor profile, and they'll even bring them to your home for you to sample. Go book a free consultation today by visiting www.litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. Again, that's litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're to transition a little bit more to your reading tastes. But before we do that, we have a little segment on here. It's called Ask the Stacks. So someone's written in to us for a book recommendation, and we have to come up with what we think fits what they're looking for.
Okay.
It's pretty, this one this week is like pretty open. It's not okay. Super specific, so don't worry. So it comes from Casey Bridges, and here's what she says. My favorite genres are fantasy and YA. Bonus points for a diverse cast of characters. I also like plain old literary fiction, especially if it's an intergenerational story. I would like to read more nonfiction. I almost always enjoy memoirs and personal essay style books, but I rarely think to search them out on my own as I gravitate first towards fiction. Some of her favorite books are Sawkill Girls, The Great Believers, The Fifth Season, Pachinko, and Heavy. So that's what she sent us. Basically, we can do anything we want because she gave us so many options. I'll start so you have a second to think. Okay. I came up with three books that I thought might fit Casey's taste. So the first one is If You Leave Me by Crystal Hannah Kim. It's an intergenerational story about Korea during the Korean War. It's told from five perspectives. It covers about 25 years. We did it on the podcast, Casey. I don't know if you remember, if you were able to read it, but it's a fantastic book and it kind of covers that literary fiction intergenerational. I also picked one of my favorite memoirs. It's called Jesus Land by Julia Shears. It is a memoir about a woman whose family, she's a white woman whose family adopts two black sons in Indiana and sends all three of them to Jesus camp. And it is dark and it is sad and it is gonna gut you, but it is an amazing book. I read it over 10 years ago and I still think about it regularly. And then my third one is a little bit not none of the things you said, but kind of all of the things you said, which is Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. And it's the book about Louis Zamperini, the runner who becomes a prisoner of war during World War II. And it is his own intergenerational story. So it's his own story. It covers a lot of years. It's nonfiction and it kind of reads like fiction. It's pretty fantastic. It's also a book I like to recommend to people who don't love nonfiction because they're just not reading the right nonfiction. So it's a good intro to nonfiction if you're feeling like you want to test the waters there. So those are mine. Damaris, did you come up with anything that fits?
Not nonfiction.
It doesn't have to be. She gave literary fiction and YA and science fiction. She gave all sorts of stuff.
So I'm thinking about the intersections of what was first described, with the exception of nonfiction. And I'm thinking she would love to read something by Nola Hopkinson. And she's initially from, or she's from Jamaica. She's a Caribbean American writer, but it's very surrealist. It has elements of I would say sci-fi, speculative, fiction, and I think it'll take her places. Mm. And that's what she wants, right? These experiences that still kind of center on understanding the specificity of identity and negotiating power, but in a context that is less familiar.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. And so she's good. But I also think another person that she'd be very interested in is Patricia Powell, and specifically The Pagoda, a novel. And this is also a Caribbean American writer, but this is a Caribbean American writer who does a lot of play on identity, including gender. Mm. And so it creates, I think, the fluidity and the accuracy of personhood without the reductive markers of identity that are familiar in standard literary writing.
Nice.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's really, I think, what people are looking for when they start to read science fiction, mm-hmm. is that they want to imagine a space that doesn't duplicate the, I would say, I don't want to say negative, but doesn't duplicate the somewhat disappointing aspects of life. Mm. And, you know, there's some science fiction that'll give you a new setting, but will still be very prescriptive about the expectations of identity markers such as race, gender, and class. Mm-hmm. And there are others that really add the dimension of humanity into an alternate space. And I think Nola Hopkinson and Patricia Powell both do that.
I want to be your student. I feel like I'm just really excited to be sitting across from you. Damaris, we're mm-hmm. going to start with my favorite. Well, not my favorite. It's just one I always start with. What are two books you love and one book you hate?
Okay. So two books that I love are The Known World by Edward P. Jones. Okay. And, of course, Beloved by Toni Morrison.
I'm very excited to talk about Beloved because I have a lot of feelings and I think that they're not the quote-unquote right ones.
Mm.
So we'll save Beloved.
There are no right or wrong feelings.
Yeah, no, I know, but I have feelings.
I have feelings, too.
I just have thoughts. I have questions and I can't wait to talk about it. Actually, I'll save it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what's the book that you hate or a book that you hate?
Oh, a lot of people are going to be mad at me.
Oh, I love when it's these kinds. Okay, go.
Listen, I couldn't even make it through The Alchemist.
Oh, I hate The Alchemist.
Right.
It's one of my brother's favorite books, and him and all his friends are like, oh, have you read The Alchemist? It's just like in The
exactly.
Alchemist. And I'm like, what happened in The Alchemist? Nothing. It was a waste of my time.
Listen, I got that. I got all of that when I was sitting in Sunday school. Bye. And it was far more interesting in the Bible.
Well, I have not read the Bible, nor have I read... Oh, I have read The Alchemist and I've read parts of the Bible, but I didn't need either, honestly.
Right.
You like, I'm just like, okay, good, bye. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the last great book that you read?
Okay, so I would say The Book of Light by Lucille Clifton. And right now I'm like kind of writing this paper, and it's a poetry book. I'm writing a paper on it. But it's one of my favorite books. It was written in like 1993, but I return to it all the time. Mm.
Do you do that often with books, return?
I do. Like, I can't get enough of Beloved. I can't get enough of The Known World. I can't get enough of Sonny's Blues. I can't get enough of Tony K. Bambara's stories. So sometimes I often return, and even at the expense of not having time to explore some of my friends and writers that are out now. Mm. But I am somebody that'll return to my friends in those pages, mm-hmm. right? They're not characters. They are my friends in those pages.
Ugh, I love that. What are some things that you're looking forward to reading?
Okay. So I have a couple of things that I want to read.
Yeah.
Roxane Gay's Dangerous Women. Mm. I have not read that. And, you know, I'll admit that I have far less time to read than I would like to have.
Right.
Starlight and Era by Ramika, I'm going to say this wrong, Binging Risher. Okay. And that's also a book of poems. And I Was a Revolutionary by one of my coworkers. I really need to get more into that book.
And what are you reading right now?
Okay, so I'm reading The Book of Light. I also recently finished, and I'm still thinking about this book called Bessie's Resurrection by Kimberly A. Collins, and that's a book of poems. At my house, I have The Apology by Eve Ensler, who wrote The Vagina Monologue. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to getting into that. Let's see. I started, but I haven't had a chance to finish yet because of my crazy schedule, but Reclaiming Our Space by Feminista Jones. Mm. So there are always a lot of books around that I want to get into, and I'm just trying to figure it out now.
And you can read multiple at once.
I can like go in and out of books.
Okay.
I used to be someone that was like kind of stringent and was like, no, I have to finish this book first. And I still have those impulses. But I think that in some ways does dishonor to my humanity and my creative person.
Interesting.
To force myself into a border and a boundary.
See, and I'm a one book pony is what I call it. I got to do one at a time. But I
you're a careful reader. That's so nice.
Yeah, I am. I don't know if I think of it as careful. I think that what ends up happening is that I end up just reading what I want to read anyways. So if I pick up a book and then I pick up another one, whichever one I liked more or I'm more into, I'll just finish before I move off.
So you're probably also one of these people that I find so peculiar.
Okay, what?
A person that will come in the house and just put their iPod on random or put their playlist on random.
I do put my playlist on random.
Right.
But it's got to be the playlist. Like, I won't put my whole thing on random, but because, I'll put like a mood on random.
Right. You put a mood on random because you're like, oh, I like all of the songs that are saved in my library, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I am not one of those people.
So you go through a playlist, you will curate it before you play it, or you'll just put an album on?
Either one.
Okay.
All of my playlists are curated.
Wow.
I listen to vinyl.
Okay, so I do that.
And I'm very specific about like coming in and playing a certain record.
Yeah, I'm more of like a mood listener. But so for my other job, I teach fitness and I have to make playlists that are very curated. They have to be 43 minutes exactly. They have to do this, they have to do that. And so when I'm not doing that, I just will put on, like, I have playlists that are just five of my favorite artists, and I'll just put all their music in a place and click shuffle.
Yeah, that'll make me.
Really?
Yeah, I think in some ways that would, that might create an energy that's unpredictable for me.
Interesting. I've literally never even thought about that I do that. I didn't even know people didn't do that.
Right. So, but in the same, it's different for my reading, right? In my reading, it's like whatever I pick up, I'll love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't have like a mood or a set, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I I feel like I'm like cheating or something. It's not cheating, but it's just like if I pick up two books and I like one more, I'm just going to keep reading the one I like more.
Right.
So that's why I read one at a time.
Well, I do have to admit this, and this is like so horrible to admit.
Okay.
Live on a podcast. Poetry books get 20 pages. Fiction and prose works get 10.
Really?
If you don't have me.
10.
By that 10th page, then we're done.
Okay, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Do you ever pick up a book because someone says to you, Damaris, you have to read this book. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
And they're like, the ending is insane. What do you do in that situation if the first 10 don't grab you?
Ask them about the ending.
Just have them tell you?
Just have them tell me.
Okay.
I'm like totally spoiled.
Okay.
I'm spoiled by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Mm-hmm.
I'm spoiled, of course, by Toni Morrison. And James Baldwin can be kind of slow sometimes.
He can be slow.
He can be slow.
See, I find Toni Morrison to be slow in the beginning. I have a hard time tapping into her.
We are going to get on that.
I can't wait. Oh, my God. I'm so – this is
– Yeah. We are going to get to it. Sherman Alexie. You know, I'm spoiled.
Interesting.
There's so much – listen, I've never been able to finish it, but even Chris Abani's Song for Night. Oh my gosh. There's so much good literature, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you got to be careful what you're spending your eyes on and
That's
your time
true.
On.
That's true. Where I struggle, and I wonder if you have this, is that sometimes when I pick up a book, depending on what I've read before, it might be very dissonant, and it's hard in the first 10 pages to get into the author's voice at no fault of the author.
Right. So I would recommend, like, if you're coming off of a heavy historical book or a memoir, to read flash fiction or very short stories before you move into your next book.
Because
that way you're kind of resetting your palette.
That's smart. Yeah. Because sometimes it's like I'll pick up something And then I'm like, I can't do this. Or like, this is terrible. But it's not really. It's just me because my brain is in like a totally different place.
Yeah. So you have to reset your palate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to read more poetry, which is really hard for me. But a month ago when everyone's listening, mm-hmm. I had Gabrielle Seville on and we talked about...
I love her.
She's so great.
Yeah. Did she tell you that we met before?
Yeah, she told me all about you. Because I said I was having you on and she's like, oh my God, I have to text her. She's great.
Yeah.
but I had Gabrielle on and we talked about poetry and she kind of did like a crash course for myself and our listeners about like... why we're not terrible people if we don't quote unquote get it. And we talked all about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And ever since that conversation, I've been like, I need to be sneaking more poetry in because it's a muscle too.
Yeah.
Just like for me, nonfiction is my go-to. Mm-hmm. And so when I read fiction, I struggle a lot sometimes, but I've been reading more and I'm getting better at it. Mm-hmm. And I think for other people, it's the opposite. Their nonfiction for them is really a struggle. And I think poetry is its own different thing that needs its own muscles and that it's not enough for me as a reader and a quote unquote professional reader to say that I don't like something because I'm new to it. And so that's a thing that I'm working on. So I'm trying to sneak some poems in between books mm-hmm. just to practice.
Yes.
And it helps.
It does help. But I also want to say like in terms of even from the writer's perspective as writing different genres, I tell people that writing fiction is like painting. It's all about what you add to the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but poetry is all about what you leave behind.
Mm.
A poem is all about what you take away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like working in negative space. So they are very kind of divergent approaches.
Right. That's interesting.
Sometimes.
You have all these nuggets. I like this. These juicy little nuggets.
Okay,
let's go. How about, what's a book that you like to recommend to people?
I like to recommend a few books, but I often recommend, let's see, Toti K. Babara's stories to my student. Well, to everybody, but particularly to my students. If I'm talking to like my parents and my aunties and things like that, I recommend The Known World. If I'm talking to an adventurous reader, I always go with Marquez and then I ask them like, what kind of time do you have? Mm-hmm. If they have a lot of time, I'll say, okay, go for 100 Years of Solitude. If they're a novice reader, I might say, which is my favorite novella by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, On Love and Other Demons, that opens up when they removed the top of the casket. There was 22 feet of red hair.
Mm-hmm.
Spilling from the casket. Right. And so then that opens up with the type of gothic lore and gore, but it's also very imaginative. What person would have 22 feet of red hair?
You know, someone exciting,
right? Someone exciting, right? A 12-year-old that falls in love with a priest.
Whoa. Is that what the book's about?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I don't know it.
It's very interesting.
What's the last really good book someone recommended to you?
Okay, I'm gonna go like really old school because this isn't. I don't think this is accurate in terms of time, but it's accurate in terms of memory. So actually, 100 Years of Solitude not only was recommended to me, but was given to me by one of my coworkers in the early 2000s. And at the time, like, let me be clear, I was reading an excessive amount of Latino literature, but kind of stayed away from Marquez because I thought it was just gibberish.
Hmm.
Like, this guy can't be that good. You don't know what you're talking about. Hmm. I'm reading these Latino women. They are feeding me. This is what I love. And also Latino poetry, because unlike English, the sounds work so much better.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was first writing poetry, I was very frustrated by English because English is like German and Latin and it doesn't do the sound,
mm-hmm.
the music
mm-hmm.
that Latino poetry does.
Mm.
And so a friend that I was working with bought me the book and it's so funny, I can't remember his name right now. And the book sat around for like 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I finally had enough time and I picked it up. And then I found myself in the last 20 pages. And this is what I do for all books that I love, poetry or fiction. And this is how I'm a balanced person. If I love your book, I will read the last 20 pages 3 times each before I move on to the next page.
Wow.
Because I don't want the book to end.
Ugh. So you'll do 3 times and then turn the page.
Yes.
Okay. So it's not like you read the, you don't go through it 3 times. All right.
No, wow. No, I'm savoring getting to the end. Right. So, you know, you can be cut off quickly, but you can also be cherished.
That's right. That's so good. Well, that's the balance. Yeah, totally. Where do you like to read? Like, what's your ideal reading setup?
Usually in the bed.
Okay.
But
morning, night, with a cup of coffee, with a snack, in socks, in blankies. Like, take me there.
Usually in the bed with, I have exceptionally soft sheets.
Okay.
I'm somebody who likes a nice bed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So in the bed, probably with a nice green tea latte next to me.
Ooh.
Or, you know, a 20-ounce mug of green tea with some honey, a little bit of turmeric, a little bit of citrus. If it's not a latte, you know, it's a whole mood.
Okay.
And then I'm like, you know, I usually kind of tuck my legs back. Like, you know, either I'm sitting on them or some way like that. And I read like that. And I have to have a book light because, you know, like you nestle on one arm and then you get tired. So mm-hmm. you have to flip to the other mm-hmm. arm. And so even though I have next to my bed, I have like a lamp that's like for the room. And then I have a floor lamp that has a halogen bulb that kind of acts like a book lamp
mm-hmm.
if I want more light. And then I usually clamp a book light onto okay. the book too.
Okay.
So it can be kind of dark in the room, but I still have
plenty of light.
For my pages.
That's good. You really took a story like that.
I enjoy a book, a bound book. I like the smells.
Yes.
I like the texture of the pages. I will read on an e-reader, but I don't like it.
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm.
I don't like it either. I did it for the first time ever a few weeks ago.
Mm.
I survived.
Yes.
But I'm back with my books. Right. I was on a trip, so.
I know. It's kind of easier when you're traveling to do the e-reader thing. Mm-hmm. Because you don't have as much weight. Because mm-hmm. sometimes, like if I'm traveling with books, I can have like 10 pounds worth of books.
I'm with you. How do you organize your books?
I organize my books by genre.
Genre.
Favorite people up front. Mm. Or favorite people at the ends.
Do you have any favorite bookstores?
I will say the Wild Fig Bookstore in Lexington, Kentucky. When I went to Bookmarks in North Carolina, it was so interesting. The Strand is always interesting. Mm-hmm. No, I'm more or less, I have books that I like libraries better than bookstores. That's the real honest truth.
Yeah.
So like, it'll be better for me to tell you like libraries that I like, you
know? Tell
me. Okay. So of course, living in Baltimore for such a long time, I love the Enoch Pratt Public Library. There are 2 rooms that I love. There's the African American room, which started in like 2004, and it's nice. But the best room in the Enoch Pratt Library is the humanities area. So it's like up on the 3rd floor, and it's like all the way to the right, and there are like columns, and there's like ornate mosaic. And it's like this whole zhuzh. Mm-hmm. So and it's very open in that space. So there's a little bit of space. They probably house about 15 computers there. Because, you know, the aesthetic of a computer, as digital as I am, can take away from the aesthetic and the vibe of a room.
Mm-hmm. Truly.
Yes. So, you know, they're all backlit and over in the corners. But when you get to the stacks...
Mm-hmm.
The stacks are narrow.
Mm.
They're on metal shelves. The books are all gold inlay and old.
Mm.
And it just smells of knowledge in there. I love
that. That's so good. You know I love a stack, obviously.
Obviously.
Obviously. Okay, let's talk about some specific things that books have evoked from you. What's the last book that made you laugh?
So the last book that made me laugh hard, I want to go with the book that made me laugh really, really hard.
Okay.
So Nikki Finney's poetry book, The World is Round, has in the middle 8 pages of the most beautiful prose in the English language.
Mm.
And it's about her relationship with her grandmother. And the first four pages are simply hysterical. And as I remember, as I was reading it, I had a mentee in the house at the time. And she ran upstairs, and I was living in a brownstone then. She ran upstairs in my house, and she was like, "What are you watching on television? I can hear you laughing all the way downstairs." I was like, "I'm reading."
Mm.
And then the very next four pages are the saddest pages that you ever want to read in the English language. And then I was crying hysterically.
Well, that was my next question.
And so the piece is entitled Hurricane Beulah.
Entitled what?
Hurricane Beulah.
Mm.
And it's all about her relationship with her grandmother. It's beautiful.
I love that. Is that the last book that made you cry, or the last book that made you cry hard?
I think so.
Okay.
This book that I wrote.
Besides the book you wrote.
Yeah. Yeah, there were times I was crying.
But in the reading of it or in the writing of it?
In the writing of it.
In the reading of it, do you find joy?
Oh, no.
No.
Sometimes when I read these poems, I'm very physically uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The first time I read the Ida B. Wells poem in its entirety, I nearly vomited on stage.
Really? Just an overcoming. It overcame you.
It overcame me. I'm extremely empathetic, even though I pretend not to be. I'm extremely empathetic. And I purposely try to write my poems to evoke some type of physical and visceral reaction because I want the reader, if they're reading about people that are marginalized, to physically feel the discomfort of being erased or marginalized body in society.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to evoke and create that for the reader. But there's no way to do it without evoking it on myself. Yeah. And so when I first read, somebody requested it. I had never read it aloud in its entirety. And somebody came to the reading, and this is in North Carolina. In Chapel Hill. And she was like, I want to hear you read Ida B. Wells. And I was like, the whole thing? She was like, yeah. And so I read it. But when I finished the opening two pages, yeah, and I was like, okay, I'm done.
Wow. Well, what about a book that's made you angry?
I can't think of one offhand that would probably evoke anger, and I would stick with it.
Okay.
Maybe reading the Constitution. They're not normal books. They're pieces, yeah. Right?
Well, we talk sometimes on here about the different kinds of anger with books. You can have anger at a book because you think that it's bad and it's annoying to you. Mm-hmm. Or you can have anger at a book because a character is making terrible decisions and it's making you angry. Or you could have anger at a book because the contents, injustice. One of the books that I think of that makes me really angry is Medical Apartheid.
Oh, absolutely.
That book, I was just like, this is garbage. This is trash treatment. I can't believe that this is the shit that people have to go through to get, so that there's these different kinds of anger in the reading. So for you, maybe the first kind, this book is garbage, I'm not going to read it, doesn't really evoke anger because you're only 10 pages in and you're moving on.
Right. Moving on. Cut my losses.
Yeah, exactly.
I do relationships the same way. You should know that.
Yeah. Moving on. Next week. Thank you, next.
But I will say there has been authors that I've read their book, and this is a different type of anger, but I'm ready to throw the book because I realize I'll never be that good.
I've heard about this from other authors before.
Right. So sometimes I'll pick up a book and...
Can you think of one off the top?
Yeah. Sarah Ahmed's work, who's the anti-feminist, and she uses a lot of Black feminist theory and post-colonial theory to talk about global feminism. And in her book, Strange Encounters, which is an older book that I read probably 8, 9, 10 years ago, she writes about how feminism is just used in some ways to promote capitalism around the world. But when I got to her chapter on Hillary Clinton, which for a lack of a better word, she's reading her politics for filth. And this is long before she's running for president, right? She's reading her politics for filth. And I'm like, oh my God, I'll never be this good. Right? Yeah, they're, you know, I read Angela Davis's work and I'm like, man, I'll never be this good. I mean, I know people, like I have friends that are so brilliant that when I get off the phone with them, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm wasting too much time watching Netflix. I need to be reading, right? Because they're just so brilliant.
Right.
But definitely I'll go with Sarah. I won't talk about any of my writer friends because there are some people that are still living, right? Mm-hmm. That like to call out their names might be like to say, you know, other people might interpret that I don't like their writing, and that's not true.
No, I think you're saying that you love their writing.
Right. But other people that are my friends. Right. Yeah, like I might be promoting some people over others, right? And that's not what I mean to do. But I mean, I'll say Sarah Ahmed is definitely one of those people. But there are other poets where I'm like, I got to learn it. But I have to learn it is a different attitude than I'm throwing this book.
Mm.
I'm throwing this book is like, I give up.
Right.
Like I surrender. I'll never be as good.
Right.
Yeah. So I do have that type of anger sometimes with people I read.
I like that kind of anger.
That's
like competitive anger.
And it's admiration.
Yeah.
Like it's just like it is the way. It's the same thing I was talking about when my mentors told me that the book was 2 and 3 books.
Mm-hmm.
I was angry, but I was angry because I was surrendering. Right. And that's not something I do easily.
Right. That makes sense. Do you have a favorite book that you were assigned in school?
Mm-hmm. Two. I like The Odyssey.
Okay.
I really like The Odyssey.
Okay.
I'm still pretty obsessed with Circe.
Okay.
I've written a play about Circe. I'm really obsessed with Circe.
Okay.
So The Odyssey is one of them. Paradise Lost by Milton is another.
Okay. Those are major books. Were those assigned to you in like high school or adult college?
Probably adult college. I think The Odyssey might have came out of high school. Like, okay. you know, you have these little programs or whatever.
Mm.
You know, they say you're gifted and talented, which just means you're probably a little bit more well-behaved than others, right? I don't know what that means, but... Right.
Nothing good.
Right. You know, it's a way of classifying people.
Right.
What else was I encouraged to read that I liked in school? I can't think of anything else at this time.
That's a good answer.
Oh no. I think I assigned that.
Maybe, okay. Tell me, what's a good book that you assigned that made you go, oh.
Yeah. When I taught middle school, I assigned this short story, Harrison Bergeron, a lot.
Say it again.
Harrison Bergeron. And it's about this boy and his abilities and how he's encouraged by society to normalize those abilities for the sake of society. And he kind of breaks out of that. In hindsight, I realized that book is probably might be some anti-rhetoric, in terms of, social equalities. But on the surface, it's interesting to think about the ways that we may police our own abilities to be accepted in society.
Mm.
And the type of internal struggle and negotiation that stimulates.
Okay, I have just the last question for you.
Okay.
This one is really my favorite. I stole it from the New York Times. What is a book you would require the current president of the United States to read?
The Diary of an Ex-Color Man.
Mm.
The Autobiography of an Ex-Color Man, sorry. That would be one. I would also require him again to read the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I think he hasn't mastered that text yet.
No.
Mm-mm.
I might require him to read your book. I don't know if he'd get it, though. He might miss it.
I don't know if he'd get it or not. Let's see. I'd assign him anything by Carol Anderson.
Mm.
And most anything by Nell Painter. And when I say most anything, I would only exclude like one book.
Her one art old in art school or was
no no no
that?
No I would have him read that too, because I think that's a way of talking about Black genius and how this there is this need and compulsion and desire to use your intellectual abilities to help substantiate the inadequacy of the academic culture in terms of race and gender and inequality. And now that she's done that work, she's painting, right? What if there was an opportunity for her to simultaneously have those careers?
Right.
Or I'm not saying that this is true of Nell Painter, but what if she had desired to paint all along, right? And actually, what type of sacrifice would that have been to the intellectual community and the American higher education system at large? You know?
So good. Okay, well, that's it for this week. We're going to be back next week. We're talking about Beloved by Toni Morrison. It's going to be a good one, I think, given what we've touched on today. There will be spoilers next week. So if you haven't read the book, you have a week. You can do it. I believe in you.
I do too.
It goes by pretty quick.
And it'll be worth it.
Yeah, and it'll be worth it. Damaris, do you have anything else you want to say before we go?
I had a lot of fun. Thank you,
okay,
Tracy.
Okay, good. I'm glad. I always like to hear that.
I had a whole lot of fun.
Good. All right. Well, we will see you next week. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you to Damaris Hill for being our guest. Damaris will be back next week for the Stacks Book Club discussion of Beloved by Toni Morrison. I also want to say thank you to the folks over at Bloomsbury. Remember, to get your book recommendation read on air, send us an email at askingthestacks@gmail.com. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. To join the Stacks Pack and get inside access to the show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegeerages. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas, and I will see you in the Stacks.